This is Share Radio Morning. Coming up between now and when Fenella rejoins us, it's claimed British consumers have been hit by a total of £300 million over the last year worth of unarranged overdraft fees.
Customers should be able to say, I don't want to be able to go into an overdraft that I haven't agreed. I would rather be embarrassed at the tills than go into debt.
We'll be joined live in the studio by financial advisor David Braithwaite from Citrus Financial Management to run through this and the other top money stories making the headlines today, including plans to be unveiled on Friday, we're expecting, about what on earth to do about diesel cars and getting them off our roads. Also, rising mortgage debt by older households. Are we ignoring older people generally, argues the papers. And the postcode lottery when it comes to 4G.
This has a huge impact on your ability to send emails, to browse the web, to use social media. And our mobile phone is central to how we live our lives today.
It is indeed. Later on, we focus on entrepreneurs at 11 o'clock. We meet the CEO of Culture Trip, a website that brings you personalised content and recommendations wherever you are, wherever you go. And Luca Falloni, founder of his eponymous menswear label.
For we are online only, so we skip the middleman, and therefore we are able to invest more in quality, less in retail markups, retail margins.
Also check in with our friends at Money Saving Expert to give our finances a good old spring clean. It's the time of year for it. And the team from MoneyWise are back in the studio with us to discuss whether going eco-friendly could save you money as well as the planet. How good are cashback schemes anyway? And who made the shortlist for the annual MoneyWise Customer Service Awards? But we are asking today, with experts suggesting a wheat-free diet may actually be bad for us. Lots about that in the papers this morning, wheat and gluten-free. However, if you take a look at the sales, free-from ranges are going through the roof. We're buying more than ever before. So I want to know, what do you buy that's free-from? Anything, and it can be for a medical reason, or it can be just because you like the taste. It can be because you've convinced yourself it's for a medical reason, a bit like my good self. A very good morning to you, Dave. Thank you very much for coming in.
Morning, Georgie.
Free-from. You a fan?
It's getting better for someone like myself. I have a nut allergy.
Wow.
So now I can look on the labels, whereas you couldn't do years and years ago, but I can look on the labels of foods that I'm buying and just check if they have actually got nuts in, whereas it used to be very hard to determine what you have. And also when you go out and eat out at certain restaurants, the menus now, and some restaurants you go into actually have folders that they come over to you and say, well, actually, you want to avoid this, you want to do this. It's more common now, and it's easier to manage than it used to be. But I've got people that work for me, a lady that works for me, she's gluten-free, wheat intolerant, all sorts. So she's always reading labels on things to make sure that what she's eating is what she thinks she's eating and not something that causes her any issues.
Allergic and intolerant, two different things, aren't they? I mean, nut allergy, I always think that must be so difficult. Going into a restaurant, surely they would just cover themselves by saying, sorry, we can't guarantee it.
Yeah, they can do, yes, they can do that. And I'm very careful. If it says on the ingredients it has a nut in it, I won't eat it.
Yeah.
But you get a lot of things where they cover themselves by saying, even bread may be made in a factory that contains nuts. And you think, well, I'm still going to eat it because I don't want to be a victim of it, but I'm just careful. But if it says nuts on the label, I won't eat it. If it doesn't state it specifically, I will run with it. And that's how I manage it. But yeah, it can be a bit nasty. If you misjudge it, put it that way.
Absolutely. For me, this morning, I had gluten-free porridge with rice milk.
Wow.
I know.
I had porridge this morning. I've started on the porridge trip like you do. Oh. I was having porridge this morning as well, you see. So
gluten-free?
It wasn't gluten-free. No, I don't think so. It was just porridge. I don't think there was gluten-free in it.
I'm not ridiculously fussy. I do just think that nowadays when we drink buckets of milk when we go into our coffee shops and everything's bread or gluten in it, well, for me, because I eat porridge, breakfast, lunch and dinner, that a little bit every so often not having it would probably be not a bad thing for me. So that's my thinking about
Excellent.
It. Yeah, why not? Janan, for you?
I quite like soy milk just for the taste.
Yeah.
No reason other than I had a sip of my lactose intolerant friend's latte.
Mm.
And I was like, I could do this.
Coconut milk is becoming very popular in coffee shops, and I accidentally got one. I did ask for a soy milk, got a coconut latte. I thought, really nice. Mm.
Is it sweeter?
Yes.
Oh, I'll have to try it. Now, I can eat coconut, ironically, because it's not technically a nut. I don't know why. But
now
yes,
you're
I could do
here.
That.
Right, now you're here. I got into a Twitter debate. I'm just going off on that. But this is slightly relevant. As to what is your favourite nut, asked one of the UK money blogger community, to which I said, well, it's got to be cashew or pistachio.
Mm-hmm.
And someone from the pensions industry, I won't mention their name, said, actually, they're not nuts.
They're legumes. Mm.
They're seeds.
Oh.
Right? So are you allowed to eat those?
No.
Oh.
Is it something to do with them? I think that some of them grow underground, and they're actually they're like potatoes. I think they grow underground, that sort of thing. Whereas a coconut grows on a tree. I don't know whether all nuts grow on a tree. Cob nuts do, don't they? I think they grow on trees. But who knew? We're certainly going left field here. But coconut for me is fine. But everything else, pistachios, peanuts, even the smell of peanut butter.
Oh, you're missing out.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, I'm definitely not. No, my reaction isn't a good one.
Well, we discuss all sorts of things here, so please do, if you want to get in contact with us about this, or quite literally anything else, then do.
You can find us on Twitter, at Shearradio UK, and you can email us morning@shearradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much, Janan.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
I'm not a peanut butter fan either. It's like sticky. So, you
know, isn't it actually quite unhealthy? Isn't it? Is it quite fattening?
Well, it's got a lot of fat. Nuts have a lot of fat in it, but they're very high in protein.
Well.
Anyway, nutrition is not my strong subject. So let's move on, because we're going to talk about money matters, which is exactly your strong subject. David Braithwaite from Citrus Financial Management. And we're going to be running through some of the top money stories making the headlines today. And there's a lot to get through today. We're going to be taking a look at 4G not spots revealed in the country. Where is the best? Where are the worst? But first, it is claimed that British consumers have been hit by a total of £300 million worth of unarranged overdraft fees over the last year alone. Now, this is research from YouSwitch, making many papers this morning, has found nearly half of customers charged for dipping into one have called their banks to complain. Two-thirds of those were immediately refunded. I wonder if that shows that they've got it wrong, or it's unfair, or the banks realise it's unfair. But either way, a lot of these are ones that... Yeah, you haven't arranged for it. Why can't the banks just stop it?
It would make an awful lot of sense. The trouble is that the banks make a lot of money, as the YouSwitch people have found here. It's 300 million. It's a lot of money. And the honest thing is, this isn't new news. This isn't new research. They've just done it this year. But this has been going on for years. And they used to charge you every time they wrote a letter. And even for those years ago, to get a letter through, you've gone over your overdraft and you've been charged 60 quid for the letter. It's a rip-off. It doesn't cost them this money. It used to be that they said, well, we've got to write a letter and we've got to post it, and it's all cost. It's all electronic now. So it doesn't cost them the money now. All the while, also, you're in credit. They're not exactly giving interest for the fine you're in credit, are they? At the rates that they should be. But being overdrawn seems to cost you an extraordinary amount. What I think that people should do, and I have this set up on my own thing where I get a text alert. If I'm getting near the overdraft limit, I get a text alert, and I have the chance then to actually rectify that before I get charged. That's a good thing. But I had to request that to be set up. So why don't these banks actually by default say, well, we're not going to let you go overdrawn. We're not going to have you, but you are going to get embarrassed at the till, as your piece said earlier, that your card could be declined if you haven't got the money in the account. But if people don't want to get charged with overdraft, then give them the option saying, I don't want to go overdrawn. That's it. And that's the default setting. And you have to actually ask them to use an overdraft. And that should be how it's done. I think for some people, they live in overdrafts. That's just the way they run their banking, unfortunately. But for most people, it isn't always a deliberate thing. It's where they've perhaps dropped in because something unexpected has happened, or a bill's come out a day earlier than what it was supposed to have done. There's either an oversight, or sometimes there's necessity. But either which way, the banks are charging far more than what they should be in a proportionate sense of what it costs them to administer that. Now, I know it's that you're in effect taking their money from them, but, you know, they make enough money as it is, I think. And some people that we see, when they get into an overdraft situation, and we've had loads of clients that have been in this, where they're trying to get out of it, but the charges outweigh what they're trying to do to get out of the financial situation. So the banks don't work with them, which just goes to show, when you do ring up and you have got a problem, half these people are getting refunded the money. If you're not happy about something, do ring your bank, because they're very keen now to make sure the customer service is delivered properly, more than they used to be before. And there's things like Twitter people take to now, and all sorts, where they can almost shame the banks into making them take notice. But, yeah, it's not a good thing, and it should stop, and it should be proportionate to the amount of expense that it actually really costs the bank, not as it is here. I see it as a fine.
All in the Sun, it's sort of suggesting here, on average, people are hit with £33 fee each time they overspend, and this can be sometimes as high as £100. And if you are trying to get out of your overdraft, it hits those people who...
It's the people that can least afford it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it also gives them a mentality. I think there's some psychological thing as well. If you have £50 in your bank account and you take £20 out. You think it's your money you're taking out. If you're already overdrawn, people just have this mentality, well, I'm overdrawn anyway, so another £20 isn't going to hurt. So they have this kind of, once you reach the below zero, your approach to your money, I think, is a different thing. And it's those very people that we should be trying to help and the bank should be helping, rather than being penalised even more and not helping them out of the situation that they find them, unfortunately, in. And that's the problem.
You can, I mean, you said you can set up things like a text messaging service that will remind you when you're going near to your limit, so then you won't have that embarrassing situation.
Yeah.
But you have to ask your bank to do this. Why don't they just do these things? And like you said, why don't they do these things automatically? Because they get so much money from it.
Yes.
And I suppose some people are arguing as well that there's no such thing as free banking, and it's this which is allowing people who are not being in their overdraft to have free services.
Exactly.
As it were.
It's the people that can't afford to pay are paying for those that can. And it's wrong. It's a little bit of a Robin Hood situation, isn't it, going on here? And you're rightly so. If you're in credit and then that's it, you might get a little bit of interest if you're lucky. But it's those very people that are paying for us to have those free banking facilities. But do register and do ask your bank. Talk to the bank as well. And they're more helpful than they used to be. If you say to them, look, I'm sick of going overdraft, what can I do? They can probably suggest you different accounts that you could switch to, the text alerts they could set up for you, or indeed change your overdraft limit and in such a way that you won't use and spend so much money on the fines that they're going to be paying.
All right, then, if you're doing that by mobile phone, it might be easier if you live in Middlesbrough. Why? Because in the sun this morning, mobile 4G coverage varies widely across the UK, but it's worse than Estonia and Peru. According to a report from Which, users can only access it, according to this, nearly two-thirds of the time, which actually is not a big surprise to me.
No, it's not to me either. There's a whole stretch of the M25 I use regularly. I have no signal on. I can't even make a phone call. And here we are in 2017, and mobile phones have been around for a long time. The difficulty I think we have is that there's not enough places necessary to put the masts. No one wants them. My parents were campaigning because there was going to be a mast up near their house. They didn't want it there, but they want to get a mobile phone reception. So you're stuck between the devil and the deep blue sea. The difficulty that we have is that I can see that this is moving towards a different way. So lots of people now don't actually have a landline phone number with a phone and an answer phone like they used to. It's all going more mobile. The same is going to happen with our broadband usage. We're going to be relying on this network to receive and have our computers wirelessly into a network rather than a socket in the wall. So we need to get our act together. And so quite ironic, I was looking up earlier on before we did this. Did you know you can get 4G signal at Mount Everest?
Wow.
Someone's actually set that up. So when you go to the base camp at Mount Everest at 5,200 metres, you can get a 4G signal.
You take a selfie and you can stick it on Facebook.
You can.
Brilliant.
Yeah, what a selfie that would be.
Wouldn't it?
But they can make that technology happen. The trouble is around here, there's a lot of built-up cities, and we're talking in London today. Lots of cities and around here have got tall buildings, and it's very difficult to get the signals always in there. And also, if you go to a crowded event, then maybe you can't get a signal because everybody else is jumping on it as well. But it does show how increasingly reliant we are on this technology and how lost we are without it. And we do expect these things to work, and we want everything quicker. And invariably, when you want that 4G signal is when you really need it. And if you can't get on there and you see a little thing whirring around, you think, oh, come on. And it's that panic when you can't get a signal, isn't it, on these things. But the technology hopefully will catch up soon. But we need to move more towards this wireless technology. And that will help all the broadband, the rural communities. We can get signals out to these people. And we're way behind, and we could be doing an awful lot better. We need a lot more investment in the infrastructure by the companies that put it all in.
David Braithwaite from Citrus Financial.
Share Radio. I'm Sue Dugan, and every week on Share Radio Morning, I bring you the life and insights of those who sit at the pinnacle of their career. Last week,
our ideal model is where we invest through the fund, and we also have one, two, three of our angel investors investing into that company.
Track record on Share Radio Morning.
Each Wednesday at 12:30, don't forget to listen to the MoneyWise show on Share Radio Morning, brought to you by the MoneyWise magazine team. Last time,
the headline rate of interest, that's calculated by the Retail Prices Index, plus 3%. March's RPI was 3.1%. From September, students who are studying will be charged 6.1% interest on their loan.
Tune in next time or listen again on our Share Radio app and on the podcast section of our website. The MoneyWise Show, part of Share Radio Morning.
A very good morning. The time is 10:47. Let's take a look at the headlines, shall we? And Brexit Secretary David Davis has rejected suggestions the UK will foot a €100 billion bill when it leaves the EU. Sainsbury's has reported an 8.2% fall in annual profits amid what it calls a challenging food market. The chief executive of Halfords has been named as the new boss of clothing, home and beauty at Marks & Spencer. And people following a wheat-free diet may be putting their health at risk. The weather sunny in the north, cloudy in the south today.
Sharing ideas about money, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Share Radio Morning with Georgie Frost.
A very good morning and welcome. This is Share Radio Morning. I'm joined this morning by David Braithwaite from Citrus Financial Management to run through some of the top money stories making the headlines today. And coming up, mortgage debt owed by older households set to double by 2030. But first, landing in front of me, the front page of the Daily Telegraph. Let's go there, shall we, David? Tory cash handouts to scrap diesel cars. Now, ministers are under pressure to get tough on drivers and improve air quality, say the Daily Telegraph, and we should get an idea of Conservative plans to reduce emissions by Friday. Is that right? Tell us a little bit more about what diesel drivers could be offered in terms of compensation to get rid of these diesel cars, which I thought not too long ago people were encouraged to buy.
And I was one of those people that were encouraged to buy it because diesel was cheaper. You paid more for the car at the time, but diesel was cheaper. You got more miles per gallon, and that was the way forward. So off I went and I bought a diesel car. Then what's happened is the price of diesel went past the price of unleaded and nothing's really changed. And you see these things, you see vehicles driving around, and every time you see a diesel lorry, every time they move away, you always see a cloud of smoke coming out the back. So I'm thinking, how could that ever was that a good idea? I don't know. So what they're looking at doing is a little bit like some of the older cars, is introducing a scrappage scheme to get these diesel cars off the roads and get more healthy, less polluting cars onto the roads. And what they're stating is 37 out of 43 regions in the country are in breach of legal limits for nitrogen dioxide, which is the stuff that these cars emit out the back of the exhausts. So I get it, and I don't think that anybody would disagree with the fact we need a more greener, cleaner environment out there. But it's a bit of a mess up from Labour's point of view, because they were the ones that introduced this and encouraged people like me and millions of other people to go off there and buy the car in the first place. So what they're looking to do is to introduce a scheme where the scrappage. So what they will say is, if you part exchange your car with a dealership that's a diesel one, we will give you a lump sum towards the deposit contribution or the cost of the new one that you're going to be buying, so long as it's probably a greener, leaner, more effective car than what you already have. This has another knock-on effect, because I remember when the first scrappage scheme came in, there were huge car parks full of cars that had been scrapped and they couldn't do anything with these cars apart from crush them, scrap them. Who's going to deal with all that? And who's going to recycle those cars and make sure that they don't end up going to the wrong places like landfill? But also, a lot of these cars are perfectly good working cars. I always think it's a crying shame when something gets destroyed that works. Whilst it's bad for the environment, at the same time, there must be things or technology, surely somebody must know something out there that they could fit to these cars to make them more fit for purpose to avoid the scrappage. Because this scrappage scheme, who's paying for that? You know, we are ultimately, at the end of the day, as taxpayers, and yet it's us that did the... I just think the whole thing is completely, as you can tell, I disagree with the whole thing completely, that we've been led a dance, frankly. And we cost money. It's cost me money. It's cost other people out there money that have gone and bought diesel cars.
I think it's rather extraordinary. Now, this is all... I mean, you're thinking, why the timeline? Why so soon? You know, give people some time. I mean, a lot of people may have only bought them a few years back and they're scrapping perfectly good cars. Yes, they're emitting all of this nasty stuff, but surely we had these limits introduced by the EU in law in 1999. We were still encouraged to buy that. Those limits were set, we were supposed to be achieved by 2010. Clearly that's way off. And actually 37 out of 43 regions of the country are in breach of legal limits for nitrogen dioxide. Now, interestingly, we had the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, writing in the Evening Standard yesterday warning that reducing heavy pollution in London, which is horrendous in some Oxford Street, it's awful. Will it make London less attractive to foreign companies, which of course at these very sensitive times people will be very unhappy about? But the government lost a legal battle against environmental campaigners and they did try to oppose this, so they do have to bring this in. When are we expecting something to come in, and will these be enough, do you think, to assuage your upset, I guess, about
it? I am, because I think, and I probably speak for lots of other people listening at the moment as well, in that we led a bit of a dance, we did what we did, was told the right thing to do, and we do that, and then it's this. How do we actually know that this is actually the right thing to do? So it causes other things to be disbelieved. You know, they had all the whole thing with, in London here, we have the congestion charge. Is that working? We're not too sure, but we know a lot of money's going somewhere. And they have the Dartford Crossing, where you still pay a toll even though the bridge was paid 4 years ago. Where's that money going for? It's a bit of a strange one, all this, because if they just told us something and told us the truth, I think we could deal with it. But it's the fact that we're told it's the truth and then it changes, and then we have to change our habits, and it costs us money in the pocket. If I change my car now, they're not going to give me a new car exactly the same as what I had, but for free, are they? I've got to pay some money for that. Where's that going to come from? Whilst I still want my son to live in an environment which is healthy and everybody else's children to grow up in a healthy environment, there's got to be something else that can be done. And I'm concerned about how much this is actually going to really cost us all in the long run. And, you know, around about time of the election as well, when they're going to announce this and how they're going to handle it, it's a bit of a hot potato, I think, this one.
It is indeed. Well, the court heard last week that there were 64 deaths each day of the year in the UK as a result of this. So lots of arguments from both sides there. We're going to move on to this. Mortgage debt owed by old households set to double to $40 billion by 2030. This is in the Daily Mail this morning. Soaring house prices, slow wage growth and crippling student loans will force more people to borrow into retirement, with one politician describing the problem last night as a ticking time bomb. The amount owed on credit cards and personal loans also soaring at the fastest pace in more than a decade. What do you make of this?
Yeah, we can see this coming as well. I mean, the trouble is as well, what this report doesn't go into too much was the fact that these people were encouraged to borrow money and the lenders were far more flexible and freer in what they lent money. So what you're seeing is a lot of people that are retired that still got mortgages over longer term. There's a load of interest-only mortgages out there that were agreed that you couldn't do now. And the lenders now are a lot tighter in what they lend people and how they do. And they want to establish that you have the affordability, not just now, but also when you're coming up to retirement. And they will drill and probe into your retirement and try and find out what you've got to make sure it's affordable now. But that's now. Before, they didn't have such stringent checks. So a lot of people are left there, and some people wanted to get on the housing ladder. They're borrowing more than perhaps what they could afford to do because they couldn't afford not to. They're borrowing over longer terms and thinking, well, we'll worry about it later on. And of course, the cost of living goes up. People are borrowing more unsecured debt. And it's going to be a very tricky situation that they're in. So where I see this going is the lenders have to be a little bit more helpful and look into those people that they believe that are at risk and get in touch with these people a lot earlier rather than letting these people find out. And we've had clients that have come to us and said, I've got this letter from my bank, I've got to pay my mortgage off next year and they don't want me anymore, what am I going to do? And by that time you've got a year or less in many cases to sort out this trouble or the problem that you have. And for a lot of people, the older that you get, when you're young, you think, oh, I'll just sell the house, it's fine. But as you get older, you might not want to do that. You don't want to go through the upheaval of selling, because that's we have this thing in England where, you know, here we are in Englishman's Homes is Castle. You want to buy, build, own your own property, and that's what you want to leave on as a legacy for your children. But if you can't pay for it, how are you going to do that? Equity release is one way that maybe people could look at. For the right people, that could be a solution. And I think that could be something that people should be looking at. But it is a bit of a challenge for those people that were lent the money in the first place to buy their home and are finding that they're now struggling to actually find anybody else to maybe take that loan on to make sure they can stay in the property.
All right, from the sublime to the ridiculous, or something along those lines. Quids on the squids. Quids on the squids. Quids on the skids, exclaims the Sun. Not so sound as a pound. What else we can talk about? Embarrassment for the Royal Mint. This is supposed to be the most secure pound ever. And yet not so much. We're seeing loads, thousands of new £1 coins are carrying major production flaws. Some have got the middle missing.
I know. It's, in a way, it's quite funny. I mean, we are laughing a little bit, but it's not right, is it? But here's the thing. I mean, there was some frauds. We were talking last week, I was on the show with Sarah, and we were talking that the first forgeries come out now. So the most forged coin was the previous pound coin, and this was the safest ever, and they're forging them now. And the trouble is that these are new coins. I was with a friend of mine the other day. It was the first one that he'd seen. So how would he know if what he's got is a forgery or is the real thing? Because he has no benchmark. So these things are coming out. But I think it's in a way quite funny because people, when the £5 note came out, people are trying to collect the ones with the low serial numbers. Yeah. So now people are looking at this new pound coin thinking, I want to find one that looks like a polo. And it makes it more interesting, I think. And we're talking about money. I don't mind it. I mean, yeah, there's going to be flaws. There's going to be. They're producing billions of these coins. So there's going to be the odd anomaly that's happening out there. But it... yeah, well, let's see what happens and see what happens on auction websites, because I think a few of those are going to start appearing on there and making them collectible. But we're talking about money. It makes money more talkable. Is it a bad thing? I don't know. But it does just go to show that they came out with this big fanfare of this is the most safest coin ever. And actually, there's a few mess ups going on with it. So it isn't quite as perfect. So it just goes to show that perhaps the Royal Mint is as human as we all are.
Isn't it just? And also, just a note, because you did mention it, the £5 note, use them by May the 5th. May the 5th, the old paper £5 note.
That's Friday. You've got to get it out by Friday.
David Braithwaite from Citrus Financial Management. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Absolute pleasure. And
thank you so much.
All of your contributions across all of our shows for this time. Thank you so much.
I'll miss you all.
We will miss you.